Hey everybody, this is Vijay Iyer here on the Jazz Spotlight.
Episode 84.
Welcome to the Jazz Spotlight, the podcast that gives you the insight and tools you need to be in the music industry today. Artists, authors, and top music industry experts give you actionable tips that will help you promote yourself the smart way. Here's your host, Jan Ilunga.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome to this new episode of the Jazz Spotlight, the finale of the series from the Jazz Festival. And today we are joined by sensational pianist, teacher, educator, Vijay Iyer. And I met him at the Pori Jazz Festival, as I told you. And we wrap up this series of special guests. So in case it's your first episode tuning in, welcome. You can go to thejazzspotlight.com/podcast where you find all the episodes, and in particular, the last 5, 6, 7 episodes have been a special series with artists from that perform at the Pori Jazz Festival. So, Vijay Iyer is here with us. And before we dive into the content, a quick note: you find the show notes with the links to everything Vijay Iyer and I talk about at thejazzspotlight.com/episode84. All right, here it is: a jazz talk with Vijay Iyer.
Hey everybody, welcome to this new episode of the Jazz Spotlight here at Pori Jazz Festival. Like you can hear, the festival is really going on. There is a nice atmosphere. And I'm with a very, very special guest here who has just been so active. He's been active on stage, performing with his trio. He has been at the signing cities, has been interviewed, and now he made some time to be here with us. And he's the leader of one of the critically acclaimed trios out there, Vijay Iyer. Their new album, Break Stuff, has received 5 stars from Downbeat magazine. And he's here at Pori, as I said, to present, or he has presented, because they already performed, some tracks from Break Stuff. I'm so honored to welcome on the show Vijay Iyer. Hey, Mr. Iyer, how's it going?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for making time. And I know that you have a busy schedule, so I want to get right down to it. So the first question I have to ask you is about Break Stuff. The title, where did you get, you know, where does the title come from? Why Break Stuff?
Well, it's really about breaks. In English, the word break normally would mean pause or space or rest. But in American, especially African-American vernacular English, when you break refers often to a kind of the breakdown, or sort of like when music is stripped down to its basic elements, or like just the rhythm, really. So often a break is not empty silence, but it's actually a rhythm. Mm-hmm. And then it also becomes a space for action. So it's the way hip-hop was born, for example, was through extending the breaks, mm-hmm. and then people would start rhyming or start dancing. A lot of new things happened, you know? New stuff, new break stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what that is. That's what it's about. So it's, you know, hip-hop, the history of hip-hop is one example, but actually this thing that's called jazz is another example, because that's the way people dealt with it, you know, in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, was they would take an existing song, like a popular song, and strip away the melody and create something new inside mm-hmm. of it. So when you strip away the melody, is it still the song, or is it some new open space of possibilities that is still musically structured and gives you sort of some guidelines or some points of reference and still has a sort of identity of its mm-hmm. own? But also you're free to, it gives you freedom to create mm-hmm. something new. So that's the whole idea that is behind really a lot of African-American music in the 20th century and 21st century. And it's sort of at the core of what we do.
Mm-hmm. And So you told us about break stuff, and I think one aspect that is very interesting about your career has also to do with your academic career. So you came from the physics world, and then you got involved with the music cognition aspect of music. So not only musically, but also somehow interaction with the, you know, how we interact with music as a way. So can you tell us more how you think having the academic background you've had has impacted your music career?
The only way it's impacted my music career is that people always ask me about it. I was a musician first. I've been playing music since I was 3, you know, and that's 40 years of my life. I studied physics for about 6 or 8, maybe 8 years out of those 40 years. 43. I'm 43 now. So music was their first, and it will be their last. It's always been part of me, part of my life. Science was something I tried and decided to quit. So it's not a big part of my life. You know, what I ended up, once I quit physics, which was 20 years ago, I started, you know, I was playing music the entire time, just to be clear, you know, and I had put out my first album 20 years ago, too, the same time that I quit physics. But what I ended up doing was sort of studying the science of music. And when I say that, I mean, how do we hear music? How do we perceive it? How do we create it? And in particular, what in our bodies makes it possible for us to do that? And when I'm, you know, it's not just about individuals, it's about how we communicate physically through bodily action that is in time, that makes sound, that has rhythm and that kind of thing. So that's something that is, you could say is universal, but it's also extremely culturally specific, you know. So that's the kind of thing that was empowering for me to study. I think actually every musician should study this because it helps you understand how music works, what people are actually doing when they hear you play. You know, do you actually, you know, it helps you understand the listener better, basically. Consider your audience in a very different way as fellow human beings, you know, at this very basic level. Basically, we're all made of the same stuff, you know, we all have the same structures in our bodies. And so when you play music, what you're doing is linking your bodily experience to everyone else's. So that's kind of what, you know, once I reached that understanding through my studies, through those studies, it helped me, I hope, be a better artist. And that's, those ideas I still work with all the time in terms of how I make artistic choices. It's with all of that in mind, you know.
And to artists whom I've been listening to, you and I, what tips would you have for them? You have been performing all over the world, and what you just told us, you know, that it's something that when you're on stage, you really have the audience in mind, not only as a group, but as individuals. So if there is someone who's listening to you and I that, you know, is performing, is getting confronted with different cultures, what should they keep in mind, if anything?
Well, culture is just a, it's a generic term for how communities communicate with one another, you know, within, you know, how people communicate within a community, right? But what we find is when we deal with these basic qualities of music, like I said, they're culturally specific, but there's also something universal about the fact that we're using our bodies to make sound, you know? And so the rhythms that are inherent to that are rhythms that everybody knows because we all have bodies that are kind of analogous or similar, basically the same. We're not that different, I guess is the point. Even though culture kind of reinforces difference. It's good to listen for difference, but it's also good to listen for what we have in common, you know? And so I guess I find that when we think in these terms, when as artists, it's good to think in these terms, in terms of what we all have in common and what we have that's specific to ourselves or to our own communities, you know? And how do we navigate those differences? So, you know, when we deal with something as forceful as rhythm, which is like an orienting principle that everybody can align with, then that's something that communicates, you know. That's something that, even if it has its own identity, it can still reach somebody in a physical way. So I guess I think about all these things, you know, and that's... but I suppose the most basic message, I mean, I already kind of said it, but the most basic message for me as an artist that I try to convey to young artists is to consider the listener. That there's something... It's easy when we get caught up in our own sense of achievement or perfectionism or trying to be amazing, you know, that sometimes we leave the listener out of that. We get kind of really caught up in our own sort of insular value system as musicians. And then that's, you know, that's when you start to lose people. So, and I don't mean to consider the listener in a condescending way or in a pandering way, like, you know, play something that people can relate to or something like that. What I mean is, what does it feel like to be in the audience? You know, what does it feel like to not be you and hear this music? That's a basic question that a lot of musicians never consider, because it's very hard, actually, to consider. But that's partly why understanding the process of listening in this very basic, almost scientific sense can help you get over that, you know, get outside of yourself. So it goes, I don't know. I mean, I still, as an artist, I am very, I work very intuitively. I you know, I work with what feels right in my gut. You know? But at the same time, I think about what it's like to not be me. Because my music isn't just for me, it's for everybody else, you know. And then there's, like, that leads you to the question of what is your music actually doing for people? So thinking of music as a service is actually really key, you know, that it's not just about achievement or about success or about excellence. It's actually about generosity and about love and about service, you know. And that also is very hard for young young musicians to bear in mind. Sometimes you just need life experience to kind of keep that in perspective.
And you mentioned young musicians, and I know that you're really active also in the education part of music, of the jazz scene. And I wanted to ask you, if you have any words of advice for someone who maybe is listening to you and I and has been thinking about enrolling at a music school, what advice would you have?
Well, I didn't go to music school, so usually I tell people not to go. Or at least, I guess, I mean, really what I do is I tell people to get a real education. Which you can't always get at a music school, but sometimes they'll lead you to focus so much on the craft that you don't read any books or understand what's happening in the world.
Society.
Yeah. So then you never think of your relation to that. You know, if as an artist, if you're going to be an artist for the next 60 or 70 years, then you have to cultivate some sense of your relationship to the world around you. You know. It's very hard to get that in a conservatory environment, you know. You really only get it by reading a lot and being around people who are different from you, you know, who think differently or have different ideas and different backgrounds. And then you really only learn about music from elders who have been doing it their whole lives. I mean, that's the best way to learn. I won't say the only way, but that's the best way to get anywhere as an artist is through sort of apprenticeship with elders. And that's hard to get in a conservatory environment too, because it tends to be more about achievement and impressing your peers and not so much about basically it happens away from an audience, you know. And the way I learned was by working with elderly musicians in the context of audiences, mm-hmm. you know, like basically playing. I learned on the bandstand.
Right.
I learned by playing with elders, playing gigs, you know, playing with people who were better than me, who could show me something and who would let me fall on my face, you know, like let me just totally mess up in front of an audience and then have to deal with it, you know.
Right.
But also, I would watch them recover from the, you know, sometimes like in a performance, sometimes you reach a moment of crisis or a moment of like instability where you kind of have to fix it, you know. Mm-hmm. So watching people make choices in those specific moments where things are starting to fail, mm-hmm. and how do they rescue or sort of salvage a situation and make it not just okay but great,
right.
you know. That's the sort of, you know, life lesson kind of stuff that you won't learn in school because you never put in those situations
right.
in school. So that's a challenge. And it's hard. I know that, you know, it's great to be in a music school environment because you have a lot of peers who are all in the same boat with you. You know?
Right.
And you, and also you have access to resources, practice rooms and instruments and so on. And that's valuable. But what you lack are all those real-world things that this
right.
music is really about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the hard thing to bridge, if you can find a way to bridge that. I mean, being in a city, like, you know, the bigger cities, like probably Helsinki or certainly Copenhagen or Paris or, you know, Amsterdam, at least you have more of a sense of continuity with the outside world. Some of these conservatories are in very isolated places where you never really encounter lifelong musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit hard.
Mr. Iyer, you've really inspired us. You really, you know, share some great advice. I want to thank you. And to wrap up this interview, I want to ask you to tell us more about your future plans. So I know that you've been here in Europe, and what is your summer gonna look like?
Well, I'm going home now that I'm done with this concert. This is our last one on the tour, so we're going home. And then I'll be with my family for a couple of weeks. And then I direct this workshop, international workshop in jazz and creative music at the Banff Center mm-hmm. in Alberta, Canada, and up in the mountains there.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be there for 3 weeks, and it's this pretty amazing star-studded cast of faculty, you know, Billy Hart and Mark Turner and Zakir Hussain and Wadada Leo Smith and Tyshawn Zori and all kinds of amazing musicians.
Mm.
So I'm really excited about those few weeks. That's going to be a real thrill and always very nourishing. And to be around these amazing students who are coming from all over the world, it's going to be pretty amazing. So that, and then right not long after that, I start teaching at Harvard again and
mm-hmm.
composing and creating. I'm recording a new album in October, a duo with Wadada Leo Smith.
Right.
And I'm writing new music for different people right now.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of different things.
Sounds like a busy summer. Mr. Iyer, thank you again for being here with us, telling us more about you and your music, and for sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. See you again.
And we are back. Mr. Iyer, thank you so much for being here on the Jazz Portal, for taking time after your gig, after your CD signing. I really appreciate you being here with us. And this is it for this special series, but of course the podcast continue. So make sure to stick around because there are more great guests, more awesome episodes of the Jazz Spotlight coming your way. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.